This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. In a typical poem by Arthur Z, you might read about Buddhist monks carrying fax machines, the physics of redshifting, mushroom hunting in the mountains of New Mexico, or a child in Hong Kong drinking Coke out of a formula bottle who has all her teeth capped in gold. The poet Carolyn Kaiser says of his work that Arthur Z possesses the gravity of the great Chinese poets as well as the levity of a Japanese Zen master. In his writing, Z draws on his many cultural influences. He's a second-generation Chinese-American who lives in New Mexico, where he teaches creative writing at the Institute of American Indian Arts. He's also known as one of the foremost translators of Chinese poetry in this country. His new book, The Redshifting Web, is a collection of his poems from 1970 to the present. I asked Arthur Z to read an excerpt from his poem called The String Diamond.
An apricot blossom opens to five petals. You step on a nail, and even as you wince, a man closes a mailbox. A cook sears shredded pork in a wok. A surgeon sews a woman up but forgets to remove a sponge. In the waiting room, you are staring at a diagram and sense compression of a nerve where it passes through the wrist and into the hand. You are staring at black and white counters on a crisscrossed board and have no idea where to begin. A gardener trims chamisa in a driveway. A roofer mops hot tar. A plumber asphyxiates in a room with a faulty gas heater. A mechanic becomes an irrational number and spirals into himself. And you wonder what inchoate griefs are beginning to form. A daykeeper sets a random handful of seeds and crystals into lots.
Arthur Z, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
I like how in many of your poems, as in this one, you set up descriptions of incongruous events that are all happening simultaneously, sometimes all around the world. I'd like you to talk about that and the thinking that went into this poem.
Well, the structure to The String Diamond is really inspired by an ancient board game, and it's best known by the term Go, which is the Japanese name, though the earliest version that I know exists in ancient China. And the board the two players play is a crisscrossed board, a series of lines, and the two players use black and white stones, and the idea is to kind of create these zones of control. And I was attracted to the Go game because it really resembles my experience of the world, that we live in a world now where it's more synchronistic in structure. There are different simultaneities. There are different worlds coming together. And rather than experiencing a straightforward linear narrative like past, present, and future, I feel that I'm more aware of different things interacting with each other at the same time. And so for me, the structure of the board game gave me a way to develop a poem that could bring in different worlds that are closer to my experience of how we live today. And so the string diamond kind of changes shape from section to section, but it has that idea of simultaneity and that sense of openness to the world.
There's a third part of this poem, The String Diamond, which is a list of endangered species. It's the most wonderful sounding names.
Thank you.
Relict trillium, tan riffle shell, humpback chub, large flowered skullcap. I had to stop when I was reading the poem and read them aloud just to listen to them. What was the impetus to make the list?
I had, if you can believe it, out of National Geographic a list of like 535 endangered, all of the endangered species. And I was just fascinated with the sounds of the words, first of all, and the names of these plants. And it struck me that it was an amazing list, that here on this sort of grid or map that National Geographic had sort of drawn up and inserted in one of their issues, was a sense of things that were vanishing from our world. Very important species. And what I wanted to do was create this list without any further commentary to give the reader a sense of things that were just here today but gone tomorrow. And the equivalent to the board the board game of Go is a beginning player tends to put one stone down right next to the other, one after the other after the other. And that's a sure way to lose if you play the game Go. What you do is you move stones around and use the empty spaces. And so for me, it became an image of loss of things in the modern world that without our realizing it are vanishing every day around us. So I took that list of 535 endangered species, and if you can believe it, over the course of a month, I played with that list and I winnowed down and I got it down to about 75 words and species that really interested me. And then it was down to like 50 and 40. And I think there are about 30 some that ended up on this list, a kind of litany.
A lot of science turns up in your writing, specifically physics. Are you a scientist first before a writer?
I'm not. It's fun for me to mention that I'm a science dropout. I'm Chinese American. I grew up in New York City. My father and mother grew up in Beijing in China, and they came to America during the Japanese occupation, actually, in the late 1930s. My father went to MIT. He had a long career as a chemical engineer. He retired. I grew up in New York City and then Garden City in Nassau County. And like a lot of Asian Americans, I was very, very good at math and science. And I applied to MIT, and I was accepted, and I went there in 1968. And life has such amazing twists and turns, you know, you can't predict. And I found myself totally bored in a classroom, and I found myself writing. And pretty soon I was writing all of the time, and I realized that this is what I wanted to do with my life, that language and poetry was so exciting to me. I just had a passion for it. And even though I realized I was good at math and science, I turned my back on that. I transferred to the University of California at Berkeley and went west and had an individual major in poetry. So I grew up with a lot of background in math and science. And I think in my early years of writing poems, I like to use a lot of words that really were based in nature, like blood and moon. And my feeling today is it can be a sign of a really good poet if you can take like bathtub or chicken wire or scissors and be able to make them poetic. And so it took me a long time to sort of face my own background in science and particularly in chemistry and physics and to begin to incorporate them into poems. So I think over the course of my evolution as a poet, I've become very comfortable using that form of knowledge because it's something that I grew up with and I try to make the best use of it.
Have you succeeded in making bathtub poetic?
Well, just the idea that I think a poem can transform or illuminate out of our, you know, day-to-day or mundane world. I like the idea that a poem isn't reserved for some special occasion, that, for instance, I can look out the window right here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and see a parking meter on the street or a car parked there, and that they can be part of the source of poetry. The whole world is there.
Did your family expect you to become a scientist?
I think that was their big hope, that I would follow my father's footsteps and become a chemical engineer. But life has, you know, wonderful twists to it. A number of years ago, my father's retired. My mother and father live in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And a number of years ago, my father had an operation, and I went to visit him in New Hampshire, and we were actually alone in the hospital room, and he turned to me and he said, well, you know, I had hoped you would follow a career in science or chemistry, chemical engineering. But when I was a teenager growing up in China, the one thing I wanted to do was to become a poet. And everyone said, no, you have to learn science. You have to contribute to China, to the cause. We need you to contribute to the country. So I found it as a wonderful kind of karmic, like, return. You know, I had never known that my father had wanted to be a poet as a teenager, and here it's something that I chose. So I think, you know, it took a number of years, but they're very happy with what's happened, too.
What language did your parents speak at home?
They spoke Mandarin, and I grew up speaking some Chinese in my family, but I couldn't really read or write it. I studied that formally at Berkeley.
I think many of us have this idea that since Chinese is an ideographic language, somehow this leads Chinese speakers to think more in images. Is that a misconception?
That's probably a misconception. I think, you know, the Chinese language is very complicated, and certainly there are some basic forms like sun or moon that are based on pictographs, on drawings of those images in nature. But there are also sound elements, and the way the language evolves over time gets to be very complicated. So I hate to generalize, but I do feel that the Chinese language and Chinese poetics has been very important to me as a poet. I've translated a lot of classical Chinese poets, and Chinese poetry likes to make very clear, strong images, and to even make the images or let the images carry a kind of emotional weight. A poet from Tang Dynasty China, like Wang Wei, can talk about sunlight shining over a piece of green moss. Now, that's an image, but in the context of the poem, it has a tremendous emotional weight. It's a moment of seeing the world in a whole new way. So I feel like I've learned very much from the Chinese language and Chinese poetics.
Do you think about how the poetry looks on the page? And I know there's certain forms, and that dictates the length of lines in some poetry, but then free verse is pretty much undictated, I imagine.
Right.
How do you decide?
I think free verse can have its own organic structures, and I really like that. I think free verse isn't just sort of writing here and there, but a poet has to find his own sense of inner structure or organic structure and use that to harness the poem. This sounds like heresy, but I write on an old IBM Selectric typewriter, and I like writing on an electric typewriter. It's about the speed that I associate or free associate with. If I write by hand, I find my wrist and my fingers getting tired after an hour or so. But if I write on an electric typewriter, I can write for a couple hours and my fingers aren't tired. And I can also see how long or short the line is. And I like that sense of having an intuitive understanding of if it's a long line, then it involves more of the breath behind the words, or if it's a short line, to me it feels more like dropping vertically, some kind of deepening. And those possibilities are always there in a poem, but I feel like I am aware of them as I work on an electric typewriter, and it helps me shape the poem.
I'm thinking of a poem of yours called The Moon is a Diamond. It's about a man, the speaker in the poem is plastering a house with a man and talking to him. And I feel that I know this person through the poem, and that I know what it's like to look at his house and the chilies hanging off of his house in New Mexico. I feel that I'm there. Is that enough for a reader?
Absolutely. I feel like a poem can celebrate a person, a situation. This poem happened one day out of the blue. I did construction work in Santa Fe with this man named Flavio Gonzalez, who was 72, and he turned to me. We were just having a break from construction work one day, and he said, you know, I think the moon is a diamond. And the moment he said that, I just was blown away. I just thought, here is a whole poem. Here's a whole vision of the world that has a kind of mystery and vitality to it. And I wanted to celebrate him. So here's The Moon is a Diamond. Flavio Gonzalez, 72, made jackhammerheads during the war, and tells me about digging ditches in the Depression for $1 a day. We are busy plastering the portal and stop for a moment in the April sun. His wife, sick for years, died last January and left a legacy, a $5,000 hospital bill. I see the house he built at 15, the ristras of red chili hanging in the October sun. He sings Paloma Blanca as he works, then stops, turns. I saw the TV photos of the landing on the moon, but it's all lies. The government just went out in the desert and found a crater. Believe me, I know the moon is a diamond.
My guest, Arthur Zee, reading from his poem, The Moon is a Diamond. He's the author of 6 books of poetry. His new book, The Redshifting Web, is a collection of his poems from the past nearly 30 years. We'll take a break now and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with poet Arthur Zee. His new collected poems is called The Redshifting Web. often landscape and landscape of the Southwest where you live is shows up in your poems. Did you gravitate to New Mexico because of the landscape?
Sometimes the truth is a wonderful surprise. When I graduated from Berkeley in 1972, I knew that I did not want to go to graduate school, and I had a little money saved, and I went and traveled around Mexico. The poet I studied with at Berkeley, Josephine Miles, said, oh, you should go through New Mexico on your way back to California. Robert Creeley is living in Placidas. I have a good friend named Stan Noyes who lived in Santa Fe. So I actually hitchhiked from, I walked over the bridge from Juarez into El Paso in September of 1972. And in one day, I hitchhiked up to Santa Fe. And I called this friend of a friend, Stan Noyes, and talked to him. And he mentioned that the Poetry in the Schools program was starting up in New Mexico, and if I stayed, I would have a good chance of working as a poet in the schools. So I really came here totally on a fluke. I had initially planned on this would be a place to stop off on my way back to California. That was 1972. It's 26 years later. Obviously, I found something here in New Mexico, and I love being here. I think the landscape is extraordinary, and in many ways, because I came to New Mexico via Mexico, I felt like I was still somehow outside of America, and that felt really good to me. It felt like a very unusual place.
You teach creative writing at the Institute of American Indian Arts. Are the students exclusively American Indians or mostly 83%, I think I read somewhere?
They're mostly American Indian. The Institute of American Indian Arts is federally funded, and unfortunately, like the National Endowment for the Arts for the Humanities, it's suffered major budget cuts over the last few years and is struggling for survival. There are 100 students, and they represent 70 tribes from across the United States. And they're all ages, from 18 to 80 years old. So it's an amazing place. If I think of the tribes that some of my writing students are from, they're from all over the country. Tlingit, Haida, Aleut, Navajo, Jemez Pueblo, Choctaw, Mohawk, Ojibwe, Menominee, Paiute. It's an amazing diversity of students, and it's an extraordinary place. They are charging tuition now, and students who are non-Indian can enroll at the Institute of American Indian Arts. And interestingly, there have been a number of women from Japan who in recent years have been interested in learning about American Indian culture and art who have come to the Institute and enrolled.
The student body is so diverse. Do they bring with them a huge diversity in what they expect of poetry or their experience of poetry?
Actually, I think many students who come to the Institute have, like society at large, a feeling like, oh, poetry is something difficult, is something, you know, a lot of the students when they come to my Poetry One class are very nervous. They feel like they're slightly intimidated. Oh, a poem that's going to be difficult or something. And then when I explain to them, they should really write from their heart. They should write very clearly. They should use visual images. They should pay attention to the sound, what they don't say as well as what they say. But just focus on the language, which is really powerful. They get very, very excited. And some of my best poetry students who have gone on and published books now were ones who like tiptoed into class and were really nervous and uneasy. And just in the course of a year, they would just be totally transformed and be so excited about writing poetry.
So much of writing poetry is truly seeing and appreciating with clarity what you are seeing. And that seems to be a central, at the center of Buddhism also. How do you describe the intersection between your interest in Buddhism or perhaps your beliefs and that vocation?
I think they really come together. I think poetry is about paying attention, about really seeing something clearly. And the practice of Zen is there could be sitting meditation or walking meditation, but it's to try and get to the essential nature of things. And a moment of revelation in Zen Buddhism is never gradual. It's quick. It's not like you get some revelation over the course of 2 hours, like a blossom that's unfolding. It's like somebody opens a door or a stone gets flipped. It's very quick. There's that flash. And I think that's something that I like to pursue as a poet. There are certain moments in the course of every day that we live that certain unexpected things happen. And if we're in tune to them, I believe that you can really see the world in a much larger and deeper way.
Arthur Z, it was really fun talking to you today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Arthur Z's collected poems is called The Red Shifting Web. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.